afternoon. This is a podcast runs through it. We're doing the podcast from home, most of us, and it happens to be snowing in the middle of May. Interesting weather. But we are also, as everybody knows, we're dealing with the COVID-19 crisis. And so I'm Nelson King. I'm up in my home here in the wine glass and joined by Dixie Hart. Hi, Dixie.
Good afternoon. I'm just about getting ready to go out and shovel the snow. I got about 2 inches on the ground here.
It is something worth chuckling about because you don't expect, I mean, it's Montana and it snows in May, but you don't expect it.
No, but we'll take it.
The other thing is that I have only been into town, I think, once every 3 weeks or so to do, you know, necessary shopping and mail run and that sort of thing. What's been your observation, Dixie, about the way people are treating the, I'll call it the relaxation of COVID-19 mitigation, you know, the social distancing and opening of shops and things?
Right. Yeah. And I haven't been to a lot of places, grocery store occasionally and the hardware store. But one thing that I have noticed is before the relaxation, there was pretty much 70 to 80% of people were wearing masks. A lot of people were wearing gloves and respecting the social distancing. And recently, that's down to, you know, maybe 40, if that many, 40% of people wearing masks and gloves. And, you know, so that's all changing. So, I don't know, it feels like people's attitudes have relaxed quite a bit about that. And you know, it's kind of concerning.
Well, it may be people are being affected by, first of all, the pressure being put on the state and the country to open up, reopen the economy kind of thing. And then like here in Montana, we're actually doing extremely well. We are 49th or 50th among all states for the lowest number of cases. And at the moment, we have only 4 hospitalizations in the entire state. And that's a fantastically low number.
Right, yeah. And we did have, you know, we had, what, 3 days in a row where we had no new cases. And I think in the last 3, it was 1 and 2 and then 1. But, you know, there's also some statistics that show that there may be more people moving around within the state and coming into the state. So, you know, I'm just hoping that people will maintain the social distancing and, you know, be using some precautions, keep those face masks on. And, you know, of course, the old standby, wash your hands.
Yeah, and I think the deliberate policy of not having, you know, sports events and big restaurant openings and, you know, where you pack a lot of people into a small area is
right.
Probably one of the best things that keep the numbers from going higher.
Right, yeah. And I noticed, I read in our paper, one of our biggest local events is what we call the Livingston Roundup, which is July 2nd through 4th, a huge celebration, which starts with probably the best parade in the country, I'm going to say. Brings thousands and thousands of people into the community, and it's just a whole lot of fun. But this year is going to be the first time since the parade was started decades ago that there will not be a Livingston Roundup parade. So that's very much a sign of the times.
Yep. Well, today we're going to we will be talking about the COVID-19 crisis, but today Dan Vermillion will be here. He's running for House District 59, basically around the area of Park County and Sweetgrass. And I'm sure that this is a different kind of political season for everybody, and it'll be interesting to see what he has to say about the changing political climate, if you want to put it that way, caused by having a double, you know, COVID-19 crisis and an economic crisis at the same time.
It's going to be interesting trying to figure out how to campaign for that. And Dan is unopposed in the primary, as is his Republican opponent, Marty Malone, which will simplify the process somewhat, but there's still the whole question of how do you do it in a year with when you're dealing with a pandemic.
Okay, well, with that, let's get on to the interview. We're going to be interviewing Dan Vermillion, who is running for Montana House District 59, which most of you have probably heard about, but we'll talk a little bit about where Dan's coming from, you know, his background and so forth, and he can describe the district to us. And also, we've got a number of issues, I imagine, that we can discuss this afternoon. So, Dan, welcome.
Thank you very much, Nelson.
And while we're also looking at a day where it's snowing like crazy in the middle of May, and we're still under COVID-19 restrictions and limitations, I assure Dan that has some impact on you, on the campaign, and probably on your business as well. But why don't you give us a little bit of background about yourself and what brought you to run?
All right. Thank you. Yeah. No, I grew up in Billings. We went through school in Billings and kind of grew up over time, like a lot of Montana kids, hunting and fishing, and went away to school for college and then came back to Montana to go to law school. And the reason I decided to come back to school to go to law school in Montana is because I knew that Montana was where I wanted to make my life and where I wanted to live, and always felt like that was a degree and an education that would give me a lot of flexibility and a lot of opportunity and options here in the state. I moved to Livingston from Billings in probably 2001 or two. My brothers and I started a business called Sweetwater Travel Company. We all were fishing guides as kids on the Yellowstone in Alaska. And then, you know, right about the time that The River Runs Through It came out, we were 19 or 20 years old. And that really kind of opened up the world of fly fishing and the ability to use fly fishing as a vehicle for creating a business. And, you know, while we started in Montana, we quickly expanded our horizons to places like Mongolia, Russia, Argentina, Brazil, and a lot of different countries. And, you know, over the last 30 years, built a business, or I guess 20 some years, built a business that, has fishing lodges in a lot of different parts of the world, including Montana. One of the things that you realize when you're out in the cold blue waters that allow us to catch the fish we like to pursue is that there are a lot of decisions that had to be made and a lot of natural resource management decisions that had to be made over time to still allow us in a world of 8 billion people to have places where natural life can still exist and still be used in a recreational manner on a sustainable basis. And so that's really what we tried to, that was sort of the world that we grew up in. And it's clearly everything's changed in the last month, but that's how we built our business. And, you know, over time, as I kind of, you develop that appreciation for how fortunate you are to make your living on a public resource, you also realize there's a significant responsibility to try to give back and be part of the decision making and the political process to make sure that the generations that follow have as close to a similar life as we have been able to have, you know, during our lifetimes. And whether that would, you know, at one time that was focusing really on strip mining or open pit gold mines in parts of Montana, to, you know, managing over the last few years, it's kind of morphed into trying to get people to realize that climate change is a real challenge, not only for my business, a recreational travel business, but also the ranching business and the farming business in this state. So there's a variety of, there were a whole lot of reasons why I eventually got involved in politics. And it's really that, you know, I was taught as a young kid that And my folks taught me by example that, you know, none of this happens by accident, and great places are maintained in great places, and states become great places to live because everybody pitches in and helps build a community that takes care of everyone to the best of its ability. And so that's sort of the nexus by which I found myself getting involved. It's both from a business perspective as well as just a humanitarian perspective that I really feel like we have a responsibility to make sure we do our best to leave the world a better place.
Yeah, and you said it already that it takes an effort. And part of the effort for you is to become involved with politics. I know you did a stint with the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Division in Montana.
Yep.
I'm sure that kind of a natural bridge from what you were doing as a guide and a fishing expert. So how did you get into that?
Yeah. So I was, part of the responsibility that I think you assume when you can make a living at a public off of public resources, also becoming involved in the management decisions that are most directly affecting that resource. So, a place like Montana, the Fish and Game Commission was a natural place to get involved. Brian Schweitzer became governor in, January of 2005, and I was the chairman of the Park County Democrats. And when they had an opportunity to appoint somebody from this part of the state to help them manage their fish and wildlife resources, I applied and was fortunate enough to be selected. And, it was really it was a really interesting 12 years. I was the longest standing fish and game commissioner at that time. And, you just realize as many, as oftentimes as I would think there was a simplistic solution to a particular problem, it's not until you're put in a position where you have to deal with all the different stakeholders and really try to figure out a way forward that, recognizes that none of us are going anywhere, and trying to create situations where people who may not agree on certain issues can still work together on others. And that is, you could see the fraying of our political process and the fraying of our political conversations occur from the time I got on there in, January of 2007. And by the time I left in April of 2019, things had really changed, and the department and the commission's relationship with the public had really changed. And, I would say they deteriorated to a certain degree, kind of on a parallel track. As you saw, the kind of the more civil natures of our civil political process start to deteriorate. The same thing started to occur in just our ability to set fish and game regulations, whether it's wolf hunts or grizzly bear hunts or bison movements. There's just a lot of different issues that became very contentious and got increasingly more difficult to resolve in a way where everybody was still friends. And, over time, I realized that as much as I care about fish and wildlife resources, that if you don't have a healthy economy and you don't have healthy social services that take and provide support to all levels of our community, the natural world is always going to be utilized for short-term gain when people are under an economic imperative just to feed their families, go to school, pay their bills, what have you. So it really felt like to me that the next step and the way to really preserve what I care the most about over time was to really get involved in a lot of the other issues that affect our community, not just fish and game issues. And that's how I ended up deciding to run for office in 2018.
Yeah, no, 2018 you ran for state senate, I believe, right? District 30?
Yep, I did. And that was, that was the first time I'd ever run for an office. And it's really interesting because it was such a different time. And you talk about, how our business has changed in the last month. Running a political campaign today versus one in 2018, when people are really under a lot of economic stress and a lot of economic pressure, and people are really taking great steps to try to be non-political during these times where everybody needs to work together. Running a campaign is, it's just a different, it's very different this time. But in 2018, I ran a campaign against John Esp. That was Senate District 30, which is basically House District 59 and House District 60 combined, and that's how you make a Senate district. House District 60 is the one that's represented by Lori Bishop, so that's Livingston. And that has consistently, you know, since she got, I think she got elected in 2016, I believe was her first year. I'm pretty sure that's right. That was 2018 was the first year we'd won that seat again or in a while since, I think Michelle Lee or maybe even Bob Rainey. So it'd been a long time since we'd won that back to back. And it feels like Livingston, you know, has changed a little bit in how it's voted, and it's going to be more of a consistently Democratic leaning seat. But the rural parts of the state and the rural parts of House District 60 and House District 59, they're still pretty conservative. And if you look at how I did in House District and Senate District 30 2 years ago, I ended up getting pretty much the same number of votes as Lori did in town. But you go 5 miles out of Livingston and vote totals and percentages dropped precipitously. So that's sort of what we're up against this time. And the reason I filed was, you know, I really care about these issues. I believe that we need to have every election should be contested, and that folks should, these are conversations we need to have this year, just like we needed to have them in 2018 and just like we're going to need to have them in 2022.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now District 59 is, population wise, what it was about maybe 20,000 people, something like that.
Well, that's a Senate district supposed to be 20. But basically House District 59 is everything in Sweetgrass and Park County outside of Livingston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe take 8,000 from that.
Yeah. So I bet it's more like 12 or 11, something like that.
And much of it is rural. I mean, there are
very
some
rural course, and, you know, which is strange because, like, you know, typically they tell you, you know, go knock on doors, knock on doors. And that was a really important way to go out and, you know, touch voters. Well, in the COVID world, people don't really want to answer their door. You knock on their door and they look at you like, oh God, who are you? So you're better off, you know, it's kind of, you know, these rural districts are hard districts to door knock on because everybody's so spread out. So maybe this is a district that in the COVID world, if you could figure out a coherent and effective way to communicate electronically with a lot of folks, I think that's going to be the push. And maybe things will lighten up so we can go knock on doors later in the year, but I just don't see that happening anytime in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I don't. And political rallies as well. You know, community forums and things like that are going to be difficult, problematic, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think I agree.
Maybe, but you know, who knows? But I was just going to ask you that, you know, I was assuming that, lockdown, COVID-19 mitigation procedures, all of this is going to have an impact on a campaign, inevitably.
Yep.
You see it changing the issues in the campaign in any way.
I think they have to. But I'm not really what I haven't figured out is how we go about discussing the issues without appearing callous. Some of these are all issues. None of them have gone away during the advent of COVID. It's just that we're all focusing on COVID so much that we're not talking about a lot of the other crises that this community was facing beforehand. The COVID crisis may actually ease up the affordable housing challenges that this community has been having, but it certainly is also at the same time going to raise the question of even if we lower rents, who has a job to be able to pay them? So I don't know. It's going to be a very different the issues. I really do think the issues will become pretty clear, and the issues that we think in the campaign like right now will be very different than the ones by September. My guess is that in September we'll be talking about competent leadership and really highlighting why people like, you know, we were so lucky to have Governor Bullock leading the state of Montana through this COVID crisis rather than, say, somebody like Governor Noem in South Dakota. Mm-hmm. So I think that competent leadership is going to be really something that people are going to be looking for. I also think that, I hope at least, that there's going to be a little bit more awareness for how important community entities like, you know, community health partners or Livingston Healthcare, the different mental health groups. There's a lot of infrastructure out there that is supporting our community right now. And hopefully, you know, I've got to believe that over the course of the next 4 months, there's a lot of folks that are going to need to rely on some of those services, and that there'll be a little bit better appreciation for why group communal action is important, whether it be just paying taxes or, you know, there's a lot of things that we can fix together that become much harder to fix if we don't work together.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously from the, I would guess, you correct me, but from the Democrats' point of view, you're looking at this as a proof positive that government is necessary and can do
I
good
sure
things.
Do.
You know?
Yep.
And if you don't believe that, well, you know, where, how are you going to survive? Now, I think most people are thinking that the COVID-19 crisis will continue. It may not be as, how should I say it, urgent here in Montana over the next couple of months. Hard to say, but probably not. But the economic crisis is going to become more and more obvious. Do you happen to know what the local unemployment figures? Have you seen any?
I haven't, but I think I have not, except to know that, you know, like all of our staff, none of them went on unemployment. That's because we applied for a PPP loan. Mm-hmm. So that allowed us. I think that, you know, the numbers you see nationally are obviously quite high. And if there's a lot of businesses like ours that, you know, were able to get a PPP loan and keep everybody employed for 2 months, you know, once that money disappears, I think it's anybody's guess that I think that number could go up quite a bit. I think Montana, basically like Park County, people are still somewhat hopeful that we'll be able to have a little bit of a tourism season. And so a lot of the pain, people have sort of put off making some of those hard decisions so far. But, you know, like you saw last week with the, you know, the parade, those are those big events that start to get tipped over. And once that happens, it becomes harder and harder for other people to continue to feel like this is going to be a normal summer. I do think that government, more so than ever, it's kind of like the COVID things reminds me a little bit of climate change. Montanans are skeptical of climate change because they can't, you know, it was snowing this morning. So, you know, sometimes that says, well, look, it's as cold as it ever was. COVID, people are starting to feel the economic pain, but they're not seeing, even though they know people are in Brazil or New York City or, you know, the nursing homes out in Washington, there's some places where COVID's really bad. They sort of don't know that it's real because it hasn't really affected Montana to a degree. We've done all the precautions without having to see a lot of sick people, but, you know, it's anybody's guess how long that'll last. And so I don't know. It's going to be a really strange year.
Yeah, I would say from a politician's point of view, it's going to be very hard to come up with a stump speech, you know?
Yeah.
What are you going to say? I mean, well, this week it's this, and next week I don't know what it'll be, you know?
It just feels like it, you know, so much of politics is when you're starting to really compare and contrast. We have kind of lost our ability, it feels like, to have conversations about political differences that, you know, it used to be you could have political differences, but y'all smiled and, you know, y'all got along one way or the other. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And when you draw political differences, people are just much more sensitive and things get much more partisan much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's going to be tricky.
Yeah, I would say so.
At some point, though, we're just going to have to take the gloves off and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, no, we're talking about the primaries in this interview because they haven't happened yet. And I remind everybody, as we will continue to do that, you know, that Montana has a primary on the 2nd of June. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I believe you're running without opposition. Is that right?
Yeah, it's funny. There was nobody clamoring to run as a Democrat in House District 59.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the same on the Republican side, right?
It is, yeah. So I'll be running against Marty Malone, who was either a two-term or a one-term county commissioner. I think he was a two-term county commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of, I mean, he's well-known in the community. And I've known Marty for a long time. So, you know, I assume that's who my opponent will be in the general. And I think that, I think it's going to be a pretty quiet year from a campaign perspective until Labor Day. And then I think things are really going to heat up quickly.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there'll be any opportunity to arrange, assuming electronic, but a debate or something like that?
I sure hope so. When I ran in 2018, I would have loved to have seen a debate. Usually what it was is we have a forum where you're up there with 8 or 9 different candidates for different positions, and you get, 3 to 4 or 5 minutes to talk. But it's really hard if your opponent says something and there's 8 people that talk before you, and then you get your chance. And I think having some debates in some of these bigger races would be really neat. I don't know how many people would pay attention, but I'd sure find it interesting. I think it's hard. I think one of the things that campaigns can be really effective at is drawing distinctions and creating conversations that are, when the two candidates are up there, they're not going to typically, at least in Montana, they're not going to throw false statements around and attack each other. It's going to be a pretty substantive conversation because there's nowhere to hide. It's just the two of you, and it's usually pretty low key and informal. So it's, I think they're really important. I hope we can do some.
Well, with given the two of you, I mean, I would consider you a moderate Democrat, more or less, and Marty's a pretty hard right Republican.
Yep.
It should be able to draw pretty clear distinctions about, I would say, for example, the role of government. Typically, one side saying that government's important and we have to use it, and the other side saying, no, we don't like government at all. The less of it, the better, And now talking in the COVID-19 and whatever you want to call this, a depression or a deep recession, what is the role of government?
Well, I think it would be very interesting to find. You'll never find me. I honestly, there are very few days where I don't drive across Montana and say to myself, thank goodness we had the legislators we had back in the 70s, because a lot of the environmental laws that have allowed Montana to remain as special place as it is were passed 30 or 40 years ago. And it's been a steady march by the Republican Party to undercut and derail a lot of those environmental rules and a lot of those environmental statutes to kind of make it easier for them to do what they want, where they want to do it. And so, government's played a really important role in Montana, and anybody who drives up the Shields on a paved road all the way to Great Falls and sees 7 cars realizes that without the government, life in Montana would be very different.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming that as it was in 2018, that healthcare will be a big issue.
Obviously, yeah, it should be.
With COVID-19 being in the mix there, but what's your sense of that?
I think, last time in 2018, we spent a lot of time on Medicaid expansion because that was clearly the vehicle in 2018 that allowed, 96,000 Montanans to stay on health insurance. And as I understand it, Medicaid expansion was passed with a sunset. I think it's in 23 or 25. So, that is no longer an imminent threat. But I do think, as you look down the road, especially in light of what the Trump administration was doing last week in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, actively trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. I think that if you're going to attack the Affordable Care Act, I think it's disingenuous to say you also support protection for pre-existing conditions, because those two things, they're inextricably linked. If you get rid of the Affordable Care Act right now, unless you pass a replacement bill, which they have shown themselves incapable of doing, you're also getting rid of protections for pre-existing conditions. And I just don't think Montanans support that. And I don't think, I just think that would be a really unfortunate and tragic turn backwards for health policy in the United States and Montana.
I would think it would be very difficult to do that in the teeth of the COVID-19 crisis, too.
You would sure think.
It reminds everybody that, public health is a big issue. And if people can't afford to go to the doctor or go to the hospital, it makes the spread of the virus that much more likely.
Yep.
And it doesn't take it's not a long argument to get into that. So,
no, it isn't. I think the other thing that's, I think we all have to be really careful about is you can see if the COVID crisis and the economic crisis continues to get worse, as it feels like it's going to, at least for a while, the pressure to start opening up some of our wild places to mineral development, or to really change how we manage this state. It's going to be great because we're going to be desperate for funds. And so I think we're going to have to be vigilant and make sure that we don't, you know, we don't make it so our future generations say, why did they do this in 30 years? Just because we're going through a hard period right now.
Now, yeah, let's focus a little bit on public lands and conservation. And I mean, it's right in your wheelhouse, of course, but there's a lot of talk right now that Republicans in Congress and probably in the state of Montana, too, are going to try to use the current crises, and I'm using the plural crises here, using that to kind of make a smokescreen for rolling back regulations and doing a lot of public land shifting, selling and moving and that kind of thing. How do you see that playing into the campaign here?
Well, I think that it's unfortunately the way these public decisions are made is they say, we're going to do an EIS, we're going to do an EIA. So changes they make today, we don't necessarily feel the impacts of those changes for several years. But I think that you just have to, it's going to be tricky because, the tourism economy, when 2018 was worth $6.8 billion a year to the state. So it was the largest the economic sector of our state because cattle prices and wheat prices were down that year. So it was a big year for tourism. This year's going to be a lot less. So it's a harder argument to make. You can just 6 to 10 years ago, everybody was saying we need oil, gas, and coal. Well, if we had gone all in the way Wyoming had into both those sectors, we'd be confronting a situation that was really as serious as Wyoming's situation is. Montana has always taken a more balanced approach. And so I think that we just need to continue to remember that in Montana, we're really fortunate that we still have clean water, we still have clean air, we still have lots of wild open spaces. And that is probably the most valuable natural resource that we have. And the rest of the world, you can find gold in other places, you can find copper in other places, but there's no other place in the world where you can find a Yellowstone cutthroat. And so when you look at Park County, you look at Sweetgrass County, we have a really unique ecosystem up here, and that ecosystem can provide value and sustainable income to our communities for a long, long time if we manage it correctly. And I think that farming, ranching, and tourism are all three very sustainable ways to use our resources in a way that supports our community. So, I would hope and I hope that we will continue to focus on those sustainable industries, make them better, make them more sustainable, because they're far from perfect. But make them better, make them more compatible with long-term use. And hopefully that is the direction that Montana continues to develop in.
Well, 30 years ago, conservation was a bipartisan issue.
Yep.
And I'm sure that in the last campaign that you were involved with, it less so. How do you see it this time out? I mean, it's really hard to predict because the environment is fluid. I'm speaking both in terms of the natural environment and the human environment. But how do you see that playing in this election? Is it going to be very polarized or less polarized? Or
I think it's going to be less polarized, honestly. I think it's, I think it's going to be, this is really going to be a discussion about the economy. And I think it's going to be a discussion about how do we go about strengthening our local economy so that we're ready to go and we can adapt to this kind of new environment that is coming. And so I think that's going to be a really important decision that we make as an economy from a political standpoint. I don't know how it's going to play out, but I think it's going to be really, I think we're going to be talking about the economy. We're going to be talking a little bit less about things like the mines and what have you, but it's going to be about healthcare funding, and social services, because I think everybody's going to feel the need for those. We're going to all need them.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into the social services aspect. I know people have been complaining that quite a few of the social services here locally in Livingston have been cut back in the last year or two.
Yep.
Or are under threat for funding and that sort of thing. Well, how do you see the picture of social services? First of all, say a little bit about what it is and what we're talking about, and then how.
Well, I mean, I guess, so in 2018, I was coming into the political process, you know, just, you know, I've been a fish and game commissioner. And since that time, last year, I joined the Park County School Board of the Livingston School Board. And being on the school board and listening to the administrators and talking to the teachers a little bit more in depth, you realize just how challenging this economy is and this community is for so, I mean, there are so many kids that just, you know, the meals they get are at school. Excuse me. And so they have been, you know, and the social services, the schools are finding themselves providing more counseling, providing more food assistance, and providing more social services, and almost being the social service hub for low-income families in Park County. And so when you look at, I think we still have job service in this town. I mean, basically, you know, the school district's providing a huge amount of social services in this district to students and families that are, you know, in need. And when they look at a five-year business model and like five-year, you know, plan for their strategic plan for the school district, social services are a huge component of what they're focusing on, because you need to get all the kids to a point where they can learn. And so to the extent that's occurring with, you know, the younger families, we know it's occurring with older families too. So whether it's senior care, whether it's, you know, how do you take care of seniors that the Medicare funding and the Social Security just doesn't come to, doesn't rise to what they need just to get through the month. And so, you know, there's just a real need for this stuff. And it's, it's sort of like preventative healthcare in the healthcare system. If you go to the doctor early and you get things taken care of or addressed before they become a problem, they're typically cheaper to fix and they're less painful for the person to fix. And I think these social services, they're the same way. If you ignore a lot of these social services, or we don't fund them and they're not available, these people don't go away. The kids don't go away. They just, you know, they fall further behind. And then when they get out of high school or they start looking for work, they have fewer options available. And members of our community with fewer options, you know, inevitably, not always, but a lot of times can, you know, society or the economy, at some point, they're going to need additional assistance. So I think that when you invest early and you invest comprehensively and you support the people that need the supporting, over time, you create stronger families and stronger communities that are that are more resilient, more self-reliant. And, you know, there are a few people that can do that on their own, quote unquote, pull themselves up by the bootstraps. But most all of us, if we were actually honest and we look at our lives, would realize that at some point in time, whether we pulled ourselves up by the bootstraps or we just had a helping hand, at some point in time, we all had a helping hand. And, you know, the more often we lend that to others as a community, the more healthy our community, the healthier our community will be.
Well, you're going to be in a, I think, in what they call the ideological bind here, where you will say, because we're having crises, and particularly the economic crisis, social services like employment services and healthcare services and mental health care services, etc., are more necessary than ever. And then, of course, your Republican opponent, Marty, is going to say, well, who's going to pay for it?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the classic problem, the conundrum, you know, so to speak.
Yeah.
How do you approach that? Or how do you see that?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that, like, you know, when we're looking like just on the school board right now, and you look and say, okay, second half or the first half, the May 15th, the May 20th taxes are due. And that's how we get people to go in and actually write a check to the county for their taxes. And that's how the school district finds out, you know, how much money it's going to have to spend for the next year. Well, people are concerned that there's a lot of folks on fixed income and situations have changed and they're not going to be able to pay their taxes right away. So there could be a hole in the schools. And, you know, it's, I think about this a lot and I don't really know what the answer to, I think, you know, if somebody comes to Sweetwater Travel and says, okay, we need to raise your taxes, we're not going to complain. We'll pay them. But we don't really have, I mean, if we don't have it, we don't have it. And so, and if we're not making enough money to pay those taxes or to create any sort of income tax liability because our business is basically at a standstill, that's where it gets really tricky. And I don't know how you generate those the resources necessary to manage a state when incomes and businesses are somewhat frozen because we can't really, our businesses are designed to work one way and that whole world is sort of non-existent right now. So I, to be honest with you, Nelson, I don't know the answer to that. I know we're going to need to figure it out because we're going to need funds. And between the oil, yeah, the gas, and the coal, it's going to be a real hole.
It's going to be a record demand for this sort of thing. But, yeah, you know, it's obviously a complex. Who pays for it? Well, the county does and the state does and the federal does. The feds do. And the mix there is going to be everything, and it's going to be difficult. I mean, we're already at a point where the Republicans are digging in their feet and saying, no money for the states.
Yep. Which, well, and I think that, you know, Montana has, we're, Montana's lucky because we do have, we're probably in as good a fiscal position because of our reserves as any state in the United States. I mean, I don't know how big our coal tax trust fund is, but it's a lot. And we've got, you know, we have a $350 million rainy day fund and we're getting a lot of federal money. So, I mean, I think Montana has ways to do it. But the idea that it's going to be without pain, I think, is naive. Mm-hmm. We can find the money, but we're going to have to, I mean, it's going to be, but you also have to have, you know, politicians and legislators up there that are willing to ask the public to help them, help us pay or help pay for these really important services that make our communities healthier. And I think, you know, one of the things that Montanans have always been very skeptical about social services because they don't generally use them. Well, this is going to be one of those circumstances where they do. And so hopefully folks will say, huh, okay, I needed these services. They helped me out. Maybe they'll be more receptive to paying it, but you know, you don't have to look too far and, the Republican world to see a lot of Montana Republicans who get quite a bit of money from the government, but still don't like the government.
Oh yeah. no shortage of hypocrisy there, but
nope.
No, you were mentioning, I wouldn't count this as a social service, but it's well known that this county, and in fact, your district, the one you're running for, has a housing problem.
Yep.
Particularly with the lower cost housing. But how do you see that being affected right now? I mean, it's really hard to talk about economic issues like this because who knows what will be like in 3 or 4 months. But how do you see that right now?
I see economic issues are going to be, I don't, to be honest with you, I don't really know. I think that we're going to have to, I mean, it's going to, a little bit of it. There's so many of the economic answers, it feels to me like that for our community that are going to be determined the next month and a half when we decide, when we know we have a clearer idea. I mean, I have a sense that we're not going to return to normal nearly as quickly as I think a lot of people feel like we will, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean, if we do start to get back to normal with the tourism side and instead of a $6 billion a year, we have a $4.25 billion. I mean, there's, you know, if we get 75 or 80% of that money, that would be great. That'll help. It's not going to, there's going to be a hole, but yeah, we're going to have to come up with some serious economic development plans. I do think that I still believe that Montana's long-term future is as bright as any state in the country's because there's just no other, I mean, there's no other place in the United States or the world that can offer what this part of the world offers to people that want to move here. And when people move here, growth will follow and economic activity will follow, mm-hmm. but it can be a little slow.
Well, that may actually bring up an interesting issue, which is that if and when the economy starts to recover, Montana's going to look really good.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are going to want to maybe move here or develop yep. here. And of course we always have this tension between development and more jobs and things like that, the perennial Republican issues, but as also not spoiling the land, you know, the old saying of paving over Paradise Valley, you know.
Yep.
How do you see that? I mean, I can guess what your position is going to be, but how do you see that?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think one of the things that was happening pre-COVID is as the tourism industry was continuing to grow, not a lot of consideration. We didn't really have a good plan for any sort of dislocation. Our folks at, were no longer able to rent houses in places like Gardner or Livingston because the demand for housing in these towns just got so high. You know, and part of that is vacation rentals. But the other part of it is this year, there was a sincere demand and a serious demand for houses. And like, I'd go knocking on doors in Livingston in 2018. And when you knocked on those doors, their little chart would say, this woman or man is 85 years old, retired railroader. You'd knock on the door and it was a 26-year-old kid who'd moved in and was fixing up the house. And so there's been a lot of demographic change in towns like Livingston. I think one of the ideas that really, unfortunately, did not get through the legislature, most the Republican side of the House last time, was an affordable tax credit and or affordable housing tax credit. And under, as I, and I'm not going to get these numbers exactly right, but the bottom line was in Montana, let's say there was a federal, you could get a 8% federal income tax credit for doing affordable housing. Well, because in Montana, the rents were not quite high enough and the cost of building was just a little bit too high, they needed an extra, like a lot of the developers that do those sort of projects needed an extra 3, 4, or 5% from the state to of a state tax credit that could be sold that would allow them to do a lot of these projects here. And so there was a proposal to do a affordable housing state income tax credit that would have created 17,500 new units in the first 8 years of its existence. And, you know, while that's not a total solution, it's something. So I think that we need to create incentives to basically build housing for that is affordable, that's more in line with the what a lot of the jobs pay around here. And, you know, is the hard part is normally you'd have just supply and demand, but when you've got a community like Livingston where the demand is probably always going to outstrip the supply, you know, when that happens, things don't get cheaper, they get more expensive. So you do need to find a way to create an economic incentive to create additional supply for the lower priced housing, the affordable priced housing, because, you know, a community without broad-based income distribution is, you know, it doesn't last long and the problems become quite glaring. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go, you go to Jackson or you go to Sun Valley or, you know, maybe Bozeman to a lesser degree, but it gets really hard. So you need to, you know, when people are paying $600,000 for a house that 8 years ago cost $250 in Bozeman, you know, nobody's wages have gone up that much and the house hasn't gotten that much better.
Yep. Yeah. It's, well, we will see within a couple, 3 months, just how, what we're dealing with in terms of an economic crisis.
Yep.
I think the final, actually, you know, we know about the COVID-19 crisis. We know about the economic crisis. And now I think we have to throw into the mix, well, here, particularly in Montana, let's say a water shortage, a water conservation, yep, crisis, or a drought, or, you know, climate change. What if we have a very bad fire season, for example, in the middle of all of this?
Well, I think that's a, it's dry right now. I mean, it's cold today, but, you know, you don't have to go out. I mean, I was digging around the down the woods the other day, and you get down about 4 or 5 inches, that ground's pretty dry. And we've been really lucky the last 2 or 3 years. We've had really good wet springs. This doesn't feel like one of those years to me. So I hope I'm wrong, but if we do get a big fire year, that's going to be, I mean, it's just not a good year for a bad year of fires. We need everything to go right this year. And, that, so that'd be a real, I mean, I think that'd be a real problem for all of us. I think that long-term, if you look at like
where the water was in 2000. So I think in 1997, we had a world, you know, we had our biggest snowpack in years. That year, we didn't get on the river until August 28th. Hmm. In 2011, we had another huge spring, you know, huge snowpack. We didn't get on the river that year till August 8th. Last year or 2 years ago, we had another one of those snowpacks that was just off the charts. We were on the river by late June. So, you know, this year we have decent snowpack, but the lower levels, you know, the lower places where snow used to fall, it's now falling as rain in the winter. And so we don't have the snowpack monitors may be up high and they make you feel like you got a ton of snowpack, but they don't always tell the story in the middle elevations. And so, you know, even this year we're at 102%. We were at 130% at the 1st of April. Now we're at 102. It gets hot the last 2 weeks of May. We're going to be on the river by June 15th to June 20th. Mm-hmm. There's not that much snow.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. And that's, you know, so that in a sense, what you're talking about, I think, Dan, is a whole lot of issues, crises in many cases, that have to be navigated or negotiated. And how else are you going to do that in the legislature unless, first of all, you admit that government is necessary to do some of this and that it has to be a bipartisan effort to make these things work?
Yeah. No, I agree. And I try really hard, although some people would say I don't. But I really try to be as fair and as bipartisan as possible because, you know, honestly, on the Fish and Game Commission, you know, if you're a Democrat and you're sitting down with the stock growers or you're sitting down with the big ag groups, you know, you're typically not going to find a lot of people that are sitting on your side of the aisle in that conversation. So, you know, you quickly have to move into the areas where you can agree and you have to figure out places that you can work together. But it's gotten harder and harder to have political people are so polarized now, and it's, you know, I just think that this is going to be our country, and all countries have done it in the past, where we somehow found a way to overcome our differences, to work together, to come up with a solution that benefits as many of us as possible. And I still believe that spirit of cooperation is alive and well in the United States, but we're going to have to really work hard once we find it to nurture it and really stay true to it as long as we can. And it's hard sometimes when you talk to somebody who doesn't believe. You know, I wear a mask in Town and Country, and I had somebody scoff at me the other day for wearing a mask. And who would have ever thought that wearing a mask in a pandemic would be a political statement?
But yeah, exactly.
I mean, that tells you how challenging, if we can't even agree on something like that, I mean, it makes things really hard.
Yep. Well, are there any issues that you would like to bring up that we haven't already covered or...
No, I mean, I think it's kind of what we ended on, and that is that, you know, I've thought there was a crisis that confronted our country for a long time, like much like you guys do for a while, and that's why I've been involved. And I think this is one of those years where everybody realizes now our shortcomings as a society, as a government, as government institutions, they're going to be painfully revealed this year. And it's going to be up to us to figure out a way to work together to make those structures better and help more people. And if we don't, I think that it may not happen this year, but at some point, the structure is going to start to crumble and it's going to be really hard. It gets harder. And when you're printing trillions of dollars at the Federal Reserve level, you realize you're having to dig deep to keep the structure intact. Mm-hmm. And so we need to do something. And, you know, the world's looking to the United States for leadership. And I don't think it's political to say right now they're not liking what they're seeing.
Yeah.
That's why elections matter.
Yeah. I mean, there's a tendency back here in Montana to say, well, the rest of the world kind of does its thing and we do our thing. But it's not that simple anymore. You know, it just isn't.
It isn't. And wait till people can't afford to come to Montana to go fishing or to go eat at a restaurant or go to Yellowstone Park because either A, they can't afford to, or B, the disease elsewhere is so serious we can't let them in. You realize pretty quickly that none of us can live alone on an island in this day and age unless we're super wealthy or, you know, we want to go live in a cave.
I've done that. Not particularly good for a long term. It's damp. Well, anyway, Dan, I really appreciate you taking the time out. Well, I suppose you have plenty of time, like we all do, in a way. But
sadly, I do.
But I'm glad you had the time to sit, you know, talk with us. And we're hoping as things develop toward the fall of the year, we maybe get you back on and talk about the issues and what they look like then. Let's say in September.
I think if you guys wanted to do a debate with Marty at some point, if we're both people who come through the primary, mm-hmm. I'd be willing to do that.
Great. So well, thank you very much, and.
Hey, Dan, hello. This is Dixie here. I was just, when we were talking earlier, hi, how you doing? Well, we were talking earlier about debates. I had sort of had that thought, well, what if we got you and Marty together and we could use the same format and have a debate? Would you be willing to participate?
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll maybe think about doing something like that.
Yep.
Great. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, guys, and I hope you have a good rest of the day and a good rest of the week.
Well, our thanks again to Dan Vermillion. I'm listening to it, and I don't know how you took it, Dixie, but I had a suspicion he's typical of the politicians right now. All of them are trying to figure out how the hell they're going to talk about the issues. Two major crises going on.
It'll be tough to navigate. And then, you know, like what, as you brought up, it's really dry out there. Hopefully we won't be dealing with fires and droughts and, you know, other natural disasters on top of all of this.
Oh, yeah. And if you live down in the eastern and southern part of the country, you know, what happens if a great big hurricane comes ashore, you know?
There you go.
Oh, boy. Particularly like Florida or Louisiana.
Right.
Anyway, those are not cheery subjects, but we need to remind people that the Montana primaries are coming up on the 2nd of June. That's not very far away. And maybe, Dixie, you can go over, you know, what's happening with that.
Right. And, you know, thanks to Governor Bullock, one of the things that he did in response to the pandemic, to COVID-19, was to ensure that we would have a mail-in ballot primary, meaning that every registered voter in Montana will be receiving a ballot by mail that you can fill out and send back in. Postage will be paid on that. So that should make it convenient for everyone in the state to be able to vote by mail. And then there'll also be in-person voting at, like here it'd be at the clerk and recorder's office. You can check with your local county to see where that open in-person voting office is, but anyway, those ballots should be mailed out, I believe, this week. They might have been mailed out late last week, so we want to encourage everybody, fill the ballot out and get it sent right back in. And you know, I think we should sort of set our expectation at what, 75% participation in the primary.
Well, I've seen some wonderful figures. I don't know if you caught that, but Kansas had an all-male primary. In 2016, they had 36,000 people ballot or vote. And this year, 400,000.
Oh, that's excellent. That is excellent. I would love to see that happen in Montana. It's usually mm-hmm. our primary. We don't have it's a pretty disappointing turnout, so maybe we can really get things off.
Well, we're going to try to remind people, you know, podcast runs through it, has in-depth interviews with many of the candidates now, and we encourage people to get informed about who's running for what and learn a bit about them.
Exactly. And in fact, we did we've had two interviews with Rafe Grable, but the one on COVID, he actually talks about how the mail-in ballot decision was made. So, he's also running for state attorney general. So people should maybe check that episode out if you want to know more.
On that note, we should close out for the day. Thank you, everybody, for listening to us. Again, this is a podcast Runs Through It with Nelson King and Dixie Hart. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Wash your hands.